Good evening. It's a pleasure to be back, and not just to teach, but to give a public lecture. And it says one screen or two. It's not one lump or two. You know, it's not like tea. But I wanted to have a look at television, and if we look at the sort of context for this talk, since I've been here, there's been quite a lively debate in different kinds of electronic and paper media about whether there should be a third free-to-air license or not. And the incumbents TVB and ATV have been somewhat hesitant, whereas CTI has been upping the ante and taking every opportunity to push for a decision one way or another. So what I would like to do is provide you with some inputs that may give you a fresh view on this discussion. I'm from Denmark. That's a tiny place. Well, it's not much bigger than Hong Kong, but in terms of its population, it's not all that big. So we're 44,000 square kilometres. If we don't include Greenland, if we include Greenland, that's another 2.5 million square kilometres. So it's a big place. So that's Denmark up there. It's pretty small, and we have 2.3 million homes, and the country is rather flat. It's not like Hong Kong, where you go in the bottom and take a lift, and you come out on the ground floor of another building further up the hill. So that's Denmark, and I thought I'd put it in traditional characters and simplified characters and in English, just to be in keeping with what happens here in Hong Kong. That's Copenhagen. I live just north of Copenhagen. Denmark's slightly smaller, and I thought I'd start by giving you some ideas about the advertising market in Denmark for media, because it's broadly comparable. Population is a bit smaller, but by the way, if you need this, you've got the handout, and if you can't decipher it in black and white, then send me an email, and then I'll send you a colour PDF. But if we look at media developments, and if we look in particular at 2008 was a defining year. It wasn't just the year in which the economic crisis got going when the Lehman Brothers went bust, but it was also the year in Denmark where advertising revenues on the internet overtook those of television. So I've had the reason why the numbers are a bit strange on the left hand side is I've converted them from Danish kroner to make it a bit easier. So on the left we've got billions of Hong Kong dollars, and on the right you've got the color code for the different kinds of media. So the medium blue thing at the top, as you can see, is growing quite healthily. Television had a bad, that should be, sorry, 2009, not this, but had a bad patch in 2009, has been growing again since then. Local newspapers are sort of doing more or less okay, and dailies are really feeling the pinch, as in most other countries. Their business model is imploding, and they haven't been able to find a good transition to a world in which they have to be present on both paper platforms and digital platforms. Otherwise, magazines are sort of reasonably stable. Outdoor, some growth. Displays in public places. Radio, you should be rather surprised. Why is advertising so low? That's simply because public service broadcasting, almost the equivalent of RTHK, even though RTHK is a state-financed broadcaster rather than a public service broadcaster, but I think it has pretensions of being a public service broadcaster. The radio market in Denmark is dominated by public service radio, so that accounts for well over 80% of the total market. So it's been very difficult for commercial players to get a foothold. And cinema is there, but it's not really a significant factor. I would imagine it's not very big in Hong Kong either. So the point here is that the internet might be something that CTI and perhaps ATV, because it's doing rather badly, could consider, and also look at the synergies of using these different platforms. So that's something about the background. We'll come back and re-examine the situation from a Hong Kong perspective. One of the other things I noted was that depending on who you speak to, you get very different responses. So the TVB executive, the CEO, interviewed, I think, on Sunday or Monday in South China Morning Post, indicated that the total market for advertising market in Hong Kong itself was about three billion Hong Kong dollars. And AdManco.com estimate the market to be considerably bigger than that. But that's the explanation of the difference seems to be the fact that both TVB and also ATV have to offer substantial discounts. So that one thing is the list price they have for their ads, and another thing is the reality, and the discounting, the discounts they're offering are quite substantial. But this is about second screen TV, and I think perhaps we need to start with some basics. What do we mean by TV? I mean, it's all about a screen-based medium, and if we look at it, we saw the cinema emerging about 110 years ago, and that was the first real screen-based medium. But television appeared around 1928 in many countries, and so we're looking, when we talk about TV, about a screen-based medium, but it's one of a number of different options. So TVs used to look like the things on the left, but increasingly they are flat screens. In principle, they could be extremely flat. These days, TVs have to coexist with other kinds of screens. So this is a fairly modern Mac, and you can see it's incredibly thin these days, although it's quite strong and very powerful. There are many people for whom computers are an irrelevance. For the people in this room, it's something we actually need for our work. But there are many adults who may actually miss out on desktop computers or even laptops and go straight to smartphones and or computer tablets. I've got a student who's doing research, and she is in the process today of interviewing a lady who's 94, whose first bit of computer technology was in fact an iPad. And it's going to be interesting to see how a 94-year-old comes to terms with that kind of technology. So we've got a lot of different. So when we talk about television, we're talking about something which is screen-based. It's not just text. It's something which is audiovisual, and it can be connected these days to a number of different networks. In the good old days, or perhaps the bad old days, it was analog technology, and television first started in Hong Kong by analog terrestrial transmissions. But it didn't take long before you had cable, and later on digital cable, IPTV, using closed internet networks, or even over the top, that's to say open internet as a way of distributing content. And in fact, there are a wide number of different networks that we could conceivably distribute on. You've also had satellite networks. Star has actually been here, but although it's not really a significant factor anymore. But we have not only devices, but also a number of different networks on which we can deliver content. And so when TVB and ATV and City Telecom are haggling about essentially digital terrestrial television, they could actually think about other ways of getting in contact with viewers, in contact with eyeballs. So TV, I think, is all about audiovisual content. That's to say, moving pictures must sound. It's not really about text, although we do have text on television. It's about delivering to screens using one or two-way networks. And from my perspective, it's more the content than the gizmos, the technology or the networks. One of the curious things about human beings is we tend to forget how rapidly things change, and this is just a summary of when people got TV. So 1928 to 1939, between the two world wars, we actually saw TV emerging in places like the US, in what was then the Soviet Union, in the UK. And it was largely after the Second World War when we saw an expansion. What's interesting on this map of the world is to look at, say, Africa and see that television came quite late to that continent. It came between North Africa came fairly early, but much of Africa didn't come until the 70s or the 80s. And if you look at India, television didn't come there until fairly late too, and that was originally things like direct-to-village satellite TV. So it was in fact the Indians who pioneered direct-to-home technology before the Americans or anybody else. So That's what I mean by television, and when we look at what needs TV has traditionally met, well, we can go back to Lord Reith, who was the guy who set up the British Broadcasting Company, as it was in the early 20s. It was it wasn't a public body; it was a private one to begin with. But he was quite an enlightened character. He had an engineering background, but he had a fairly broad sense of what media should be used for. And he was the one who coined this phrase to inform, to educate, and to entertain. And I think that is the value proposition. You know, if you're in marketing, you would be thinking about the value proposition. That's essentially the value proposition for television, with a slightly different weighting depending on whether you're commercial or whether you're state financed or if you're public service. And ultimately it's about engaging the viewer or the audience, because if they get bored, they're just going to turn off. So it's very much about doing something that people feel like watching. When I was a kid, that proves how ancient I actually am, but when I was a kid, we didn't even have a TV to begin with. It didn't emerge until I was about 8 or 9. So to begin with, we used to listen to the radio. And broadcast media at that time were very much social media. We talk about social media and we think about Facebook or QQ or things of that kind, but social in the sense of face-to-face contact rather than virtual contact. So I reckon I could well have been the small boy there when I was that age. And then TV emerged, and you used to have to wait for a couple of minutes to turn it on until there was a picture in glorious monochrome. It wasn't even 625 lines. It was smaller than that. So it was something that got people talking, and this social dimension to television is something we shouldn't overlook. It isn't the same as a PC. It's something where we actually often want to to interact not with the program, but interact with the other people who are in the same room sharing things with us, and perhaps get annoyed or upset or enthusiastic about what we're seeing, but at least to discuss with somebody else what we're actually experiencing. And I think that applies. This is a photo I found on Flickr forum. So it's still the case in rural China. There are 900 million people in China who don't have access to between 800 and 900 million people in China who don't have access to the internet. And for them, the dominant communication and information media are mobile phones, but also television. And I think even in the 21st century, for some people, in some parts of various countries, television still plays the same kind of role as it did when I was a kid. Or if we take other emerging economies, who take India with more than 300 million television households, you've often got an extended family watching TV together, and it's a very lively experience. So it's often the interactions taking place among the people viewing which are just as important as what's on the box. And if we come back to the so-called industrialized world, even in Hong Kong during the Olympics or a couple of years ago during the World Cup, I would have imagined at least some of the male members of the audience would have been glued to a set at home or in a bar or somewhere else, watching the football or watching table tennis or whatever. And sport on television is still very much a social event. It's almost a tribal phenomenon where people meet up, and it's not particularly funny to watch a football match on your own. You really want to do it with your friends or your family or in general terms your mates. So I used Lord Reith's dictum about television being about informing, educating and entertainment. And if we look at the kinds of things we're talking about there, we can say things like news, current affairs. In terms of education, it can be campaigns, awareness building, to take a fairly politically correct example. In the UK, there are about 12 million offliners. The population is 60 million, but there are 12 million people who have never, ever even tried to get online, never, ever tried to use the internet. And there's a national campaign in which, in particular, television is being used to create awareness, to do something about the attitudes, to get people started. And we go between summertime and wintertime in my part of the world. So when we go from summertime to wintertime, we actually have an hour. You can sleep an hour longer because when you go from summertime to wintertime, there is an hour. And the campaign is just called Give Me an Hour. And it's actually slotted in just around the end of summertime. And it's quite smart. It asks people in the community if they're prepared to spend an hour with senior citizens just to explain why they're using things like the internet and other technologies and why it might be a good idea to give them some inspiration to get them started to do some of those, to break down some of these mental barriers. So television may not be particularly effective at the nitty-gritty of teaching and training, but it's pretty good at setting the agenda. It's pretty good at saying, here we have a problem that needs to be addressed. And of course, if you go further, things like documentaries often have an impact, but primarily through decision makers rather than the population at large. So So when things like radio, later on television, were introduced, it was very much something to do with information, education. And this business of entertainment was mentioned as largely as an afterthought. But these days, I think the entertainment tail is in fact wagging the dog. For many people, they're not really that interested in the first two columns. It's in fact entertainment which is the driving force for them. That's fair enough. So if we look at this business what needs does TV currently meet? Some of the figures I'll be talking about stem from a report which was published in October by the Open Society Foundations. This is sort of something which was set up by George Soros, and they're actually doing studies in 58 countries. And their study of the mainland was published here in October, and it's produced by a number of Chinese researchers. It's in English, and it's been sub-edited, so the English is fairly easy to read, and that's why I've given you the link so you can actually download it. It's free. I found it useful to know that there were 513 million internet users at this time last year in China, 155 million broadband subscribers, over 1 billion mobile phone users. Okay, there's nearly 2 billion mobile phone accounts, but when you look at it, it's like in Hong Kong, a lot of people have more than one SIM card, or in my case, I'm walking around with two phones, one with a local Hong Kong China phone from China Mobile and my phone from back home, so that I can receive phone calls and messages, but I don't use the data services because roaming will be too expensive. So we have quite a lot of people actually using different kinds of technology, and television is no longer on its own. And it's also interesting if you look at data, okay, which is now 5 years old. If you look at what media do people use in the mainland, if they do have access to the internet and if they don't have access to the internet. If they have access to the internet, that they're less likely to use television. So they're far more likely to use the internet than TV. On the other hand, if they have internet, they're more likely to read newspapers. That's probably an indication of who actually has access. They would, all things being equal, would be urban rather than rural, with a reasonable education rather than a more modest one, probably with an average or above average income. So these factors taken together would probably explain that. More likely to listen to radio if they're net users. They're certainly more likely to read books. So I don't think it's the internet per se, but it's some of these other background factors. So even if they're net users, it doesn't mean that they stop using any other kind of media. But it just means that if you're in rural China, if you've got a more modest background, it's very likely that television will be one of your main sources of information, along with what you get from your family and friends, and also what you pick up from your mobile. And so if we look at things like news, I think we can make a distinction between hard news and, is it Minqing? More, something with a more human interest, more local focus. The figures for television news are not exactly impressive. This is the share that the main TV shows actually have or had in 2010. And if anything, I think CCTV's ratings have been declining faster than the commercial competitors. So if you look at Minqing, in Nanjing or in Guangdong or in Shanghai, you're seeing ratings which are significantly higher than that. Take things like radio. We noticed a couple of slides back that radio seems to be something that has something to do in some cases with educational background, and we can certainly see that there are a number of different radio stations and even news programs of a kind in the mainland. And when it comes to portals, QQ, Sina.com, Seoul, and News163 are the four most popular portals. So if you live in rural China, probably you're going to be dependent on television news as your main staple, apart from things like the current price for pork or honey or something of that kind. But generally speaking, you're going to be dependent on what we could call the old media. And if you're an urbanite, if you certainly have access to the internet, then your media habits are going to be very, very different. So television, I would claim, depending on who's doing it and in what context it's being used, is still pretty good at creating awareness. It can reach a lot of people rapidly. And if we look at the educational dimension of electronic media, here too there is a significant competition. I think it's worthwhile looking at the annual disposable income if we're looking at the mainland, the difference between urban and rural households. So if you're living in rural China, you've got an average household income a few years ago of about 5,000 RMB a year, whereas at that time the average urban household would have three times as much. Okay, arguably the cost of living is slightly higher in urban China, but it's not three times as much. So that's going to have an impact on what kinds of media you can actually use, because you've got to pay for electricity, presumably. You've got to buy a device, whether it's a TV set or a set-top box or a mobile phone, and that's going to cost you something. So perhaps when we're looking at the business of empowering the population, if we look at the urban population, maybe some of the things that are being done on mobiles are probably at least as important as what's being done on TV, and that would also be related to things like credibility. Do people actually want to listen to all the things they hear from CCTV? Do they find it relevant to their particular needs and interests? Although CCTV's style has changed dramatically in the last 4 years. I don't follow the services in Putonghua, but I can certainly follow the English language program. It's very, very different from what it was just a few years ago. But I just took an example which you can have a look at on the BBC's website, and I would think that China Mobile, as part of its corporate social responsibility, is actually having a go with this network called Longxingtong, looking at how they can make a difference to the rural community. And the guy on the left has in fact managed to improve his beekeeping business and his sales of honey, and in fact even sell consultancy services because he can actually go online and actually communicate. I don't think this is the kind of thing that television can really help. very much. It's good at doing a documentary, showing examples of things, but it's there's no way in which television can actually compete with a service of this kind. Whoops, I pressed the wrong button. I'll just have to continue. I'm making a podcast, so if you want it afterwards, you can get it. So we've been looking briefly at things like news. We've been looking at education. Perhaps we should go on and look at things like entertainment. And one of the things that intrigued me was something like Supergirl as a phenomenon, just representative of a number of different shows, and the fact that a regional TV system operating on satellite and being distributed by cable could actually reach an audience of 400 million quite easily in the summertime when school kids and university students were on holiday, and actually engage young people in a way which their betters in Beijing didn't necessarily think was appropriate. Clearly, if you're getting people to do something as harmless as vote for different candidates in a talent competition, a number of people might start to think, okay, we're voting here, but we don't actually vote very much in other contexts. So we saw new guidelines for content, for television content in the mainland in December last year, which meant that you can actually only have two of these entertainment formats in prime time a week now. And in fact, Supergirl was taken off because it overran by 8 minutes in relation to its official time. So keeping time seems to be important in certain contexts. So I think it's understandable that there is a discussion about what media should be for and what entertainment should be all about. And perhaps some of the entertainment we've seen has been what was mentioned in the report from the Open Society Foundations as vulgar. Perhaps lacking in what the ruling classes would regard as tasteful. So perhaps some sort of discussion on what you want to use media for is quite important. Certainly, do you want to have homegrown things or do you want to have imports? That's the kind of debate that's been going on in Hong Kong in connection with TVB, which has still been able to produce quite a lot of content itself, whereas ATV has been it was initially quite successful in cutting back its production of say TV drama and using localized imports, but you can get so far. Ultimately, you have to be able to produce compelling content about your culture and for your culture, and not just rely too much on exports or on imports. And the other problem seems to have been that if you focus on delivering not just to a Hong Kong audience but also a Cantonese-speaking audience in the Pearl River Delta, taste are different, and Hong Kongers might regard some of the things that have been happening on ATV as dumbing down, actually doing things which don't actually suit people who are somewhat more sophisticated, somewhat more savvy in Hong Kong. So my claim is that TV in the 21st century needs to redefine itself. So things like control, I'm talking not so much about political control, but user control or user choice or user participation. Oh, I keep on pressing the wrong button, sorry. I have to be careful about that. Participation seems to be a strong driver. We can see that in other parts of the world. But when we have a talent show like X Factor or Come Dancing, and there's voting in that, these have fairly big audiences, typically between 1 and 1.5 million of the 5.5 million Danes are actually watching on Friday evening. And about 20% of those will actually be voting. I find it a bit strange, but if we look at something which has broad appeal, people want to have a say, and participation is something that's always been there. We've had phone-ins and other ways of actually taking part, even in radio programs. So why not have the option of sending in emails or text messages as a way of participating? We've also got to look at how we actually make sense of all these multiple platforms. If you take the example of the BBC there, you can receive many of the BBC channels in the UK on 46 different kinds of device and network. So you name it, even things like Nintendo Wii and Sony PlayStation, you can actually watch on demand some of the BBC's programming through the iPlayer. Mobility. I showed a picture of somebody's guess about the forthcoming Samsung Galaxy 4. But smartphones and computer tablets are clearly going to be pretty widespread. We're already seeing that they're selling more boxes than things like laptops at the moment. So it's fair to say that these may well be the first truly personal computers. I don't think many of the desktop computers were that personal. The fact we're walking around with something actually changes people's behaviours quite considerably. Several of the people I know in Hong Kong have given up using email only for professional reasons. Everything else is subsumed into Facebook or some other social media app on their phones. And immersion as a phenomenon. If you're looking at what television is or what television might become, that's a dimension to be looked at. You may have seen in the last few days a documentary about 8K, sort of super high definition TV, which is being tested in Japan. Well, when you've got a picture which is 16 times the detail that we actually currently see on a high definition, maybe something like 3D isn't that important anymore. It does become quite compelling. And the immersive nature of something like computer games or the immersive nature of a TV documentary can actually make quite a difference. On Saturday, I was dragged off to the cinema to see The Life of Pi at iSquare, the IMAX cinema here, with a degree of trepidation because I rather liked the book, and I was worried in case the film wouldn't necessarily meet up to my expectations. But it was quite a good film, I thought. I was a bit picky about certain things, but in general, it worked quite well, and it was certainly immersive. I'm very pleased that it wasn't what we call smelly vision, that you couldn't actually smell the tiger's breath, because on occasions you felt that the tiger was only centimetres away from your face because of the 3D effects. So, can we write off TV? Lots of people have written off broadcast television. Born 1928, died 2020. Some people are assuming it will be dead and buried within the next 8 years. I'm not so sure. I think if we take the case of football, there are enough compelling events for people to actually want to share experiences together and not just go to the cinema. And after all, we may go to the cinema, in Denmark, on average 2.5 times a year. So that means on an annual basis, we've already consumed the same amount of television in about 1.5 days. So it's in a different league. So cinemas are very immersive, whereas the basic staple for non-tech stuff still tends to be television on some platform or other. if we look at that business of football, because some people in the room might find it interesting. Here's some figures. I'm sorry about the poor picture quality because Bo Olufsen from Sky provided a rather low res PDF, but here's what happens on a typical Saturday afternoon in the UK. A match between Manchester City and Manchester United. I think there's one coming up again. That's at the local derby in Manchester. Pulls in 4 million pay TV viewers in the UK. But on top of that, it's 1.7 million viewers in pubs and in clubs. So they're the club or pub owners are paying a subscription to be able to show televised football matches on big screens. And there are 250,000 people who would have liked to have seen things with their mates, but for various reasons couldn't do so. So they don't want to miss out. They want to be able to talk about the match at a later point. So they see that on Sky Go, which is an on-demand service on smartphones and tablets. Or take entertainment. This Stellar is one of the series that launched. If we look at how much things have changed, we used to think about live, the first transmission of a television program. It's 24% here of the total viewership. That's the blue area. And if you look at time shift, premier time shift, that's people looking at the same program, not when it's aired, but perhaps within a few hours on their PVR, their hard disk recorder, or some kind of catch up. You've got that's for that's the 37% there. Sky On Demand is actually going online and actually looking at it there. Repeats, which is the yellow area, and recordings of repeats, and then a small bit on the 2% is for watching programs on smartphones or tablets. Well, if you look at that, it's quite interesting. If you were just relying on broadcast on your terrestrial signal, or in this case Sky's satellite signal, and you didn't have these things, you would be missing out on about three quarters of your audience, paying audience, if in the case of Sky. So when we're talking about second screen, what we're looking at is some kind of one element is actually combining both broadcast and internet signals in one and the same device. You're still using a remote to actually, so it's still a televisual experience, but you can actually get the best of both worlds. Not the text part, because you don't really want to do that. You don't necessarily want to check your emails or do your home banking on the TV set, but many of the other things make a lot of sense, and there are several different ways of doing this, all of these open standards. And then the second screen scenario is very much about using something like an iPad or a smartphone as a way of interacting with the content as an alternative to the remote control. And in that way, not having to do rather tacky things like sending text messages, but if you've got voting, you can just press an option, something which is far more in tune with what you're doing. And the tricky thing there is to make sure that what happens on your little screen is broadly in sync with what happens on the big screen. So this is by no means pie in the sky. It's already happening. It only accounts for something like 2 or 3% at the moment. But asynchronous use, seeing something when it's not being broadcast, for the whole of TV consumption in the market like the UK is around 12%. And some of it is to be able to see things when you want to or where you want to. Some of it's in fact using this second screen phenomenon. I'll just give you some examples of what we're talking about, because we have to be finished in 12 minutes. So we were talking about some of these components. I would think that bit up there is largely about improving convenience. It's not about making things more immersive, but actually making things a bit easier to use if you're a typical viewer. And if you're not a typical viewer, if you've got difficulties actually understanding things, you may be ancient like me and therefore find it a little bit difficult to understand people who speak fast. You've got better control over what you're looking at. So in this particular case, you can actually get, you can call up sign language if you want to. And that bit is being delivered using the internet onto a TV screen, and so it's still a TV experience. But it's a lot cheaper for the organization to do just that. Or if you need subtitles and you need to be able to adjust the size, the contrast and the color of the subtitles, because a lot of people have very different visual impairments, you can actually then tailor them. And this is a no-brainer for a broadcaster to be able to put together an application of this kind. And catch-up TV, you might want to say, okay, this is the news. If you want to have a more segment about that particular story, then you click here, and then you can either see it now or you can book it to see it when the news is over. So you've got a lot more user controls, you've got improved choice, you've got very good catch-up TV options. Well, I think probably the most important thing to think about when it comes to second screen isn't so much the banal things of convenience, but perhaps focusing on the participation. And this is a study which you can actually Google and find on the net by a company called Edelman. It was a study done in the UK and the US in March this year, so the data is fairly new. So they looked at what people think are important, and so personal enjoyment of entertainment, they're looking for excellent visual or sound quality. And if we look at 2012, people are becoming increasingly egocentric. So it's me, it's my TV, it's not our TV. Fairly intolerant, being able to access entertainment immediately, purchase entertainment easily, thinking about the hours of enjoyment the entertainment will provide. So these are some of the things that people claim are important. What I wanted to focus on in connection with second screen is the fact that if we look at what people do, of course they've always talked about TV, but they've also talked about other things too. But about more than half of what gets talked about on Facebook actually is about media. And you also get some discussions on YouTube, Twitter, and so on. But that number of about half of the people with a Facebook account, and that's again. So we're talking about 30-40% of the population in a country like Denmark are actually talking about television, but they're talking about it on Facebook. So in this particular case, the orange numbers are to do with the UK, and the blue ones are about the UK. There are some slight cultural differences, but what people actually do, if they enjoy something, they want to tell a friend or they want to tell a family member. They might actually want to search for more information. If they don't like it, they're even more likely in the States to actually say that was really trash, to warn their own particular circles that might not be a good idea. And the other thing that's I found of interest is this statistic looking at when do people actually comment on things. So before seeing something, so they might be asking around, do you have anything you would recommend me watching? And then during a program, it's about the same number, and then afterwards, it's considerably higher. My claim is that if we look at some of the things on second screen, that's just, you know, on a smartphone or on a computer tablet, some of these discussions, which are essentially replacing the discussions with the people in the same room, will be taking place on these devices. And where I see a potential for actually doing something is, in fact, looking at social media, which allow people, certainly in things like entertainment, to actually discuss things and do things together in the same way as they would do in the living room. And here are some preferences. I recommend you actually have a look at that study if you're interested. You can Google it and find it fairly easily. So what does this all mean in a Hong Kong context? Perhaps with a quick look over the border in the mainland. It would seem to be necessary for TVB and ATV to look at new ways of user control, user choice and participation via social media. After all, I think that there's advertising revenues that they could actually think about, which could tie in far better if they look at free-to-air television and some accompanying service. And secondly, it might be a way of attracting a younger demographic. I would guess that a number of the people who actually watch TVB and ATV aren't exactly young. Well, it could be the middle-aged and their kids, but all things being equal, I don't think it's something that young people would actually choose to do on their own or with their mates. It's not really that kind of media experience. If you actually think about, in a more consistent way, about greater control, greater convenience on the second screen, but also greater participation, allowing and building up social media fora to allow people to discuss your content, I reckon this could be a way of actually encouraging a younger demographic to watch TV. So it's interesting in particular for free-to-air broadcasters to use over-the-top internet services on TV sets. So actually having a second screen option is a way of redressing the balance. If you're running Now TV or a system which has a return channel, you can in principle do all this yourself, but it's so much easier, in fact relatively cheap, for TVB and ATV for that matter City TV, if they want to look at some of the pay TV offerings and make something more compelling by allowing a greater degree of participation. And I also reckon this could be a roundabout way of actually doing something about participation in the mainland. So now there are fairly strict quotas for entertainment. It wouldn't be all that difficult to move some of the activities onto the internet, certainly in urban China, not so much rural China, and essentially do many of the things they've been doing in the past, but just using a second screen scenario, another way of delivering things, and another way of allowing people to participate. So that was it. I've managed to get there just about on time. If you've got some questions, I'll be happy to deal with them. And you kept awake, which was very impressive. Thank you very much.